guessing that this is about as many folks as we'll have. We almost didn't have me because I thought it was after supper that I was scheduled, and but I'm here for the benefit of the tape ministry. My name is Solveig Cheseth, and the topic we'll be talking about are Angola and Mozambique. This session is a continuation of yesterday's look at the effects of South African destabilization on the region of Southern Africa. And I think that word destabilization is so misleading because it sounds not as bad as it is. And really it's for the states, for the countries surrounding South Africa, Malawi, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, Namibia, Angola, Lesotho, Swaziland. The reality of South Africa's war against that region has meant a cost to the region of about $60 billion and 1.5 million lives over during the 1980s. From the period 81 to 89. So destabilization is kind of a mild term. Yesterday we looked at the effects in all of those different countries. The destabilization efforts of South Africa have affected the countries in different ways, depending on their proximity to South Africa, their transportation possibilities, and so forth. But I wanted today to look more closely at two of those countries, the two which have been the hardest hit by South Africa's policies. And those two are Angola on the west coast there and Mozambique on the right coast. And let's start with Angola. Both of these countries were colonies of Portugal since the late 1400s. And the Portuguese occupation of these countries differed from that of the people in South Africa and Namibia in that the Portuguese did not set up through legislation and through the constitution the pattern of apartheid or total racial separation and discrimination. But the reality was for the black living in either Angola or Mozambique that the black person had virtually no possibilities whatsoever to develop herself or himself. The ratio in Mozambique, for example, was 100 to 1, 100 blacks for every white Mozambican, and yet there would be virtually no blacks in what would be the equivalent of our high school. There simply were not educated black Mozambicans or Angolans. I think, especially in regard to Angola, we need to look at U.S. policy as a part of the background here. The U.S. policy toward Southern Africa as a region basically has, except for President Kennedy, had been one of disinterest. And I think we don't need to go too much into the details of that, except to say that when President Nixon took office, he turned most of his foreign policy power over to Kissinger. And Kissinger commissioned a study. Kissinger complained about how in the world do you make policy in Africa when there are so many different nations and so forth. He commissioned a study of U.S. policy in the Southern African region. And this was to be a secret study that would help us determine what our agendas would be in the area. It was completed in 1970. And basically what the researchers decided was that the white minority regimes would be in power in Southern Africa for the foreseeable future. And therefore, the decision was made to lower the profile of our talks with the independence movements and to increase our support to South Africa. This was not made public until somebody leaked a copy of this. It was called the NSSM, National Security, and the last word is memorandum. What is it? Study memorandum, 39. And then it caused quite a stir. But whether or not it was openly admitted, the movement of our U.S. policy was quite clear. One of the ways it was made clear, and this is not directly relating to Angola, but as our ambassador to South Africa, President Nixon appointed a Texas oilman, John Hurd, who showed particular insensitivity in his post. One instance that is told and retold is when he went hunting on Robben Island, where Mandela and others were being kept as political prisoners. He went to the island not to meet with these people, but to go bird hunting. And prisoners were forced to retrieve his birds, like bird dogs. And that's an isolated incident maybe, but I think it gives a feel for the insensitivity that we have shown towards Southern Africa. Now, coming back to Angola, Kissinger had great sympathies with Portugal, partly perhaps because they were members of NATO. And so we provided to Portugal military aid, including napalm, as the liberation groups in both Mozambique and Angola were fighting for their independence. Portugal assured us they were not using it in Africa, but it was clear that they were. In 1974, the Portuguese government was overthrown, and that in effect meant that we had these countries of Angola and Mozambique were now independent nations. In Angola, there were three liberation movements that had been fighting against Portugal. One of these, and I certainly don't, the initials always are confusing, but the FNLA, National Front for the Liberation of Angola, is the one that initially we decided we would back. For one reason, the leader of that movement was the brother-in-law of Mobutu, who is our crony now in Zaire, and I'm certainly hoping our relationship with Mobutu will soon be ended. But we agreed actually to support them, not so much because we admired them, their ideals, or their leadership, but because we knew that the Soviet Union was backing another group, the MPLA, Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. It's kind of the policy was made because an enemy of my enemy is my friend. The Chinese government was helping at that time the group called UNITA. Their leader, Jonas Savimbi, had studied in China and was professing at that time to be a Maoist. And these two groups joined together, became allies of sorts. The group we were backing and then the Chinese back group. The United States gave $14 million in aid in 1975 in this three-way struggle for power in Angola. Aiding UNITA, in addition to the United States, was South Africa, and of course Zaire. But we were giving some overt support and then secret CIA support. And probably as a result of this, the MPLA sent out a call for help and the Cuban government responded. And so the stakes just kept going up. The Soviet Union sent in more equipment and military aid, and we got deeper and deeper. South Africa got deeper. In 1975, toward the end of that year, U.S. Senator Dick Clark, who was from Iowa, was one of the early folks to discover the extent to which we were becoming involved there, the extent of the CIA covert assistance. And he managed to get passed through Congress what was called the Clark Amendment, forbidding further covert aid. In the early months of 1976, the MPLA was victorious. The MPLA with the help of Cuba. And this was very humiliating, both for the United States and especially for South Africa. To be defeated in their part of the world, to be militarily defeated, because they were openly there fighting, was a tremendous blow to South Africa. And for us to have Cuban soldiers active in a defeat was a humiliation. The other significance, or the significance, one of the significances, how do I say that, of this whole armed clash was that so much of the whole region then began to be seen in terms of an East-West conflict. The United States trying to protect our friends, the Soviet Union trying to assist their friends. And so for really a couple decades, that part of Africa, the southern part of Africa, has been held hostage to this East-West struggle. The cost to Angola has been of this continued struggle, of the continuing attacks by UNITA and South Africa, has just been immense. The sabotage of the transport routes, this one, the Benguela corridor that used to help Zambia and Zaire and Angola export its goods, that was cut off. The rail systems within the country, the transport, as I said yesterday, really has ground to a halt. The food shortages have become massive in a country that used to be the breadbasket of that region. And now certainly within the last few months with drought, the food shortages have become even worse. Another tactic of UNITA was to plant landmines in the fields and along the village paths. And Angola has become the amputee capital of the world with the largest, highest per capita rate of lost limbs in the world. And it's very sobering for us to realize that some of those mines certainly were at U.S. taxpayer expense. They were our mines. Up to 75% of the village water systems have been destroyed. At least a fourth of the health and education centers are gone. The defense spending for this country of Angola has been $8.5 billion, which was equal to half of all the government spending. Over 500,000 people have been killed since 1980, which amounts to 5.5% of the population. And the loss to that economy over these past years is figured at $27 billion. In 1988, for a variety of reasons, South Africa realized that it would have to withdraw from Namibia. And there were complex peace accords negotiated and finally signed in New York in December of 1988. And these called for the withdrawal of South African troops from the lower part of Angola and from Namibia. It called for the gradual withdrawal of Cuban troops. More than half of them have left, and the rest are scheduled to be gone by mid-1991. And it called for the end to South Africa's assistance to UNITA. And when all this would have happened, or when all this had happened, then we had independent, free elections in Namibia, leading to Namibian independence. Well, as South African aid was cut off from UNITA, unfortunately, the United States increased the amount of aid that it was providing. And the repeal of the Clark Amendment in 1985 allowed for us to begin doing covert aid. We have been giving, our aid level has been at the rate of $50 million a year, although this summer now President Bush has requested an extra $15 million. We have been airlifting in the supplies from up here in Zaire. Remember our friend Mbutu. From the Kamina Air Base, we have been airlifting supplies in support of UNITA. Now this February, I'm trying to go very quickly here because we still have Mozambique to talk about. But in February of this year, the Angolan army moved very swiftly down into the southeast part of Angola, which was traditionally UNITA territory. In fact, they held a town that was only 20 miles from Jamba, which is the headquarters for the UNITA troops. And this was an interesting test of strength because for the first time, Cubans were not involved on the Angolan side, and theoretically, at least, South Africa was not involved on the UNITA side. They captured the town in February. They held it. There were fierce battles, and they withdrew in May. And one of the interesting reasons behind President Bush's request now for an additional $15 million is that Jonas Savimbi has made another trip to Washington. UNITA has an incredible public relations firm in Washington that they spend millions of dollars on, and these folks produce for them. And Savimbi said that U.S. aid had been very effective in this battle for Mavinga, and he mentioned specific weapons, recoilless rifles that they mounted on Toyota Land Cruisers that we airlifted into them. So the assistance from U.S. taxpayers, Savimbi had felt, was crucial in defeating the Angolan army. I should say that the United States has consistently, since 1976, refused to recognize the government of Angola as a legitimate government. We stand alone. All our allies recognize that government, all the countries of Africa, with the exception of South Africa. So you can imagine what that does to the image of the United States, certainly on the African continent, where we are clearly linked with South Africa in attempting to overthrow what all the other nations have said is a legitimate government of Angola.
What is our reason? What do we give for the reason for not supporting that government?
A variety of reasons. One is that Savimbi now is not saying any longer that he's a Maoist. He quit saying that when he quit getting support from China. Now he says he's a capitalist, he's an anti-communist. And again, we are so easily manipulated by people smart enough to say they are anti-communist. That's certainly one thing. Another thing I think is the humiliation. We don't like Cuba. We don't like Cuba in Cuba, and we certainly don't like Cuba in other parts of the world. And so that has been, in fact, for the Namibian, our country insisted that as a precondition for Namibian, for free elections in Namibia, the Cuban troop withdrawal must have begun from Angola. And so the Namibian people were real angry for 10 years. They were directly held hostage to this U.S. foreign policy agenda of wanting the Cubans out of Angola. Other reasons why we support Savimbi?
Well, I think it's an anti-communist thing carried to the nth degree, and it's one of the last places where the real strong anti-communists in this country can have some kind of an agenda. And we've talked about this. You write to your people in Congress, and you don't get any answer on this one. The administration has just made a decision to do this. I think it's a sop to Jesse Helms and to lots of people like that, and it's a hostage to domestic U.S. domestic politics. And our other friends, as Solveig said, I think have just decided not to tangle with U.S. on this one. So Britain and all the other countries recognize Angola, but they will not criticize us or tangle with us on this.
You know, sometimes when we've talked, we just wonder if there hasn't been some sort of a secret deal made in Washington that the people who really want a new policy in Southern Africa will let the conservatives have support to UNITA in exchange for other things. I live back in Dubuque and keep writing to Senator Grassley about aid to UNITA. And it used to be that Ila Wiblin and I would get answers from his staff about, well, we've got to fight the communist influence there and the Cubans. Now that the East-West thing is over and that the Cubans are going out, the last letter we got from Grassley was, well, the DeSantos government has a bad human rights record.
Right, I just read that letter.
Yeah,
just a few minutes ago.
And so the reality is that they've lost their old justifications, but they're not moving their policy.
And one of the ironies, which I think is fun to point out, is in the northwest part of Angola are big American U.S. oil companies. And for much of 1980, during this time, the so-called Marxist government of Angola and its Cuban allies were protecting these oil refineries from attacks by Savimbi, who is supposedly our friend. I mean, it's really, logic fails you when you look at Angola and our policies. Now, I was just reading this summer, in news this summer, there is evidence of increased South African support again for UNITA. And the way they are doing it, they can no longer move up through Namibia. But a number of South African airlines have admitted that they have a significant number of planes, chartered planes, rented planes, that are flying into the bases in Angola, into UNITA bases. So once again, South Africa is reneging on agreements. Since April now, there have been peace talks between the representatives of UNITA and the Angolan government. The Angolan government was very disappointed. They had hoped that they would get U.S. Recognition of their country when we used to say they had to send home the Cubans. Well, now they're doing that, and now we still refuse to recognize them. And that was, I think, a major disappointment. Dos Santos, who is the leader of the Angolan government, has pledged now an open ballot. There may be other parties on a ballot. He has talked about the expansion of democracy. He's talked about reforms that would move them more toward private sector, encouragement of the private sector. So he has certainly come a long way in trying to reach out toward UNITA. But in a sense, our increasing aid to UNITA makes it less necessary for UNITA to negotiate. Peace talks were scheduled in June, and after a day or so, UNITA broke them off. Now they were to happen again in July, and I don't know if they have. But that's where we sit with Angola. You know, with the U.S. playing a very significant role in the suffering of the Angolan people. And then we look at, finally, Mozambique. What is the time? How much time do we have left? Because
we've got 22 to 6.
Okay. We need to be through before the next bell rings, right? So we don't all miss supper.
No, the next bell is at 10 past.
Okay. Mozambique is this long country here. It runs about 2,000 miles from the northern tip there, bordering with Tanzania, to the southern tip down here with South Africa. It has about 15 million people. There are about 15 million people in Mozambique. And Mozambique is the nation that has suffered the most from South Africa's destabilization. The independence, the liberation group in Mozambique called Frelimo, which I assume stands for, again, Portuguese words for liberation of Mozambique, fought for 10 years, and then that the success of these liberation movements, both in Angola and in Mozambique, is in part credited for the overthrow of the Portuguese government, that so much of their resources were being drained off in these two liberation battles in Africa. So Mozambique does have potential for development. Right now, only 1 acre in 5 of their farmland is being used. They have forest land, they have grazing land, they have sugar and tea factories, they've got cashew nuts as an export crop, coconuts, coal, natural gas. And then they point out that their mineral resources, which probably exist, have not been tapped, whereas some of the other Southern Africa, South Africa, Namibia, they've been mining for years. And so Mozambique is assuming that they have some vast mineral resources also. As I say, they became independent in 1975, and for the next 5 or 6 years, there was a tremendous excitement, the heady experience of being a liberated people and of working together to build the Mozambican country. They set about to develop their nation, to provide for their people, which had been as deprived as the Angolans under the Portuguese. The illiteracy rate, for example, at independence, the illiteracy rate was 93%. And one of their leaders now, in talking about those early years, said, after independence, we turned the whole nation into a school. 5 years after independence, they had reduced that illiteracy rate from 93% to 72%, if you considered everyone in the population. If you took only the age group between 15 years and 24, the illiteracy rate was down to 52%. And I have seen something just recently that they have lowered it to about 35%. So tremendous progress, especially in the first 5 years. They placed a great deal of emphasis on rural primary health care, on preventive health care. During the years from 1976 to 1981, they exported record amounts of cashews, of cotton, of coal. And they really began the building of the social structures. They had a community-based court system with locally elected judges, and I thought it was interesting, the percentage of toilets of, minimal modern facilities, said the prospects were bright. We had a 10-year development plan. We were looking forward to the 80s, to what we called the decade of victory over underdevelopment. They had made all this progress in the first 5 years. This is Mozambique, and the first 5 years of independence had really turned around the health care and the educational opportunities for their people. And then in 1980, Zimbabwe was independent, so they, in support of the Zimbabwean struggle for independence, Mozambique did a tremendously costly thing. It closed its border with, there was this worldwide blockade or boycott or embargo of against Zimbabwe. They closed their border, which meant that the Beira corridor and their other export routes really almost closed down completely. It was a tremendous sacrifice on the part of the Mozambican people, but they made it for the sake of the liberation of Zimbabwe. And that liberation came in 1980, so that was another thing to rejoice about. The transport corridors could be reopened. And another thing happened in 1980 that gave great encouragement to Mozambique, and that was the formation of what is called the Southern Africa Development Coordination Conference. This is a union of all these frontline states in which they agree to work together economically. That as individual nations, they are pretty powerless, but they would work together for the development of the whole region and certainly a clear purpose of SADC, as it is called, was to reduce the dependence on South Africa on the parts of these countries, to improve the transport, the export out of the Mozambican ports so that these countries would not be dependent on South Africa. But the prospect of a successful black nation right there on its border was one that was tremendously threatening to South Africa. They knew that this would, A, cut into, economically it would hurt them because the nations the frontline states who were opposed to apartheid would use Mozambican ports, but even more important probably would be the psychological damage, because South Africa liked to have people understand that if the majority rule comes about, if black people take control of the government, it'll be chaos. And here they had just next door to them a black government that was making tremendous strides in caring for its people. And so the decade of the 80s was not a victory over underdevelopment for Mozambique. It has been a horror story. We need to back up a little bit. In 1977, a Rhodesian white by the name of Ken Flower, he was head of the Rhodesian Central intelligence organization, or the CIA. He was concerned because soldiers fighting for the independence of Zimbabwe were in Mozambique. And so what he did, this Ken Flower, was to organize from former Portuguese Secret Service, from the defectors from Frelimo, from people willing to sell themselves. He organized a group in Mozambique. Initially it was to ferret out the plans of these liberation fighters that were fighting for the liberation of Zimbabwe. That was in 1977. Well, that Zimbabwe became independent in 1980, and its new president, Robert Mugabe, gave these RENAMO forces just 24, 36 hours to disband. And the RENAMO forces were given the choice of either disbanding or of being turned over to South Africa. We looked at a video the other night. The quality is so bad, otherwise I would have shown it to you. But you hear this Ken Flowers, it's an interview with him, and he's telling about the transfer of this terrorist group to South African control. And he said there was no question, they jumped at the chance now to fight for South Africa. So they were airlifted, flown from Zimbabwe to South Africa. And then the numbers, it still was a force of maybe only 2,000 people. But South Africa built up the numbers in a couple ways. One, by arresting illegal immigrants, people coming down from Mozambique to work in the mines illegally, and forcing them into RENAMO. And then later, as RENAMO began its attacks in Mozambique, a main source of recruitment is forced recruitment. They would attack the villages and force the young, especially young boys, to fight with them. In 1981, they began their attacks in earnest in Mozambique. And remember, up until then, there had been this sense of triumph, this sense of hope and optimism. And Colonel Van Niekerk ordered the attacks on Beira Corridor, that's this trading route. This one that serviced Zimbabwe and Zambia, on the Nacala trading route, and then on the Limpopo trading route, or corridor as they are called, and really effectively cut off those trade routes, which made all of this part of the country completely dependent on South Africa. And a second goal of RENAMO was to destroy the Mozambican economy in the rural areas through death, terror, mutilation, and kidnapping. South Africa would provide the sophisticated weapons, the equipment to sabotage the oil lines and the power stations and the ports. South African soldiers would carry out the commando raids. South Africa would supply the aircraft and the submarines and the parachute drops. And then this illiterate group of Mozambique and this ragtag bunch would do the terrorism. And we know very clearly these plans. We have the quotes of the commanders and so forth, because from two sources. One is kind of interesting to us personally, because it was a couple of people that we met when we were living in Harare in Zimbabwe. During this time, in the early 1980s, there was a young couple living in the northern part of South Africa, who had a chicken farm and raised chickens, just relatively innocent. But they had a friend who had been drafted into the South African Army, and this friend got assigned to a Colonel Van Niekerk. Apparently this friend was a nice, charming guy and got a very high position. I mean, he was a trusted secretary to this colonel, and he realized that what he was seeing coming across this man's desk were the plans for destabilizing, for these attacks in Mozambique and for attacks in Angola. Ms. Van Niekerk and his supervising general were in charge of this tremendous, devastating attacks on these other countries. And this friend of theirs, this young soldier, began making copies of everything he saw and bringing it to their chicken farm. And then they would eventually get the information out to the Mozambican government. And eventually South Africa realized that somebody is knowing when we're going to do, quite precisely what we're going to do and when. And these three young people were arrested. The only thing that kept them from, well, who knows, death perhaps, was, or at least life imprisonment, was the fact that the information that they had access to was so terribly crucial that South Africa realized they could not charge them with possession of these documents, or the documents would be revealed in court and the whole world would see what South Africa was doing. So these folks were charged just with possession of banned literature. And the young soldier was sentenced to 6 years, the young woman to 5, and the young man to 4. And we happened to be living in Harare just as the woman was released. Her husband had been released, and they went immediately into exile. But it was their information that allowed the Mozambican government to know quite precisely what was going to happen. And then in 1985, the Angola, or the Mozambican government, captured the main base of the RENAMO forces and found documents that, looking back, unfortunately they weren't able to predict what would happen, but documents that showed the very clear role of South Africa in all of this, even after the signing of the Nkomati Accords. That was in 1984, with Mozambique literally forced to its knees. South Africa and Mozambique signed an agreement that each would recognize the sovereignty of the other country, that Mozambique would not allow ANC forces to be in its country going to attack South Africa, and likewise South Africa certainly would not aid RENAMO. But the documents found a year later were convincing evidence that South Africa had never for a moment intended to live up to that agreement. So the suffering in Mozambique over this past decade is called a Holocaust. The number of deaths is enormous. The cost militarily to Mozambique has been about $325 million each year, which was not nearly enough to repel South Africa. They have suffered nearly a complete breakdown in the social structures. One half of the Mozambican population are refugees, either refugees out of the country or refugees in other areas than where they used to live within the country, and dependent on food supplies. The farming sector has been severely damaged because the farmers, the peasants, were targets for Renamo terrorism. There have been nearly 1 million war-related deaths. That's 6% of their population. Nearly half of the children, half of these, nearly 500,000 were children under 5 years of age. And then in Mozambique, even more so than in Angola or some of the other nations that have been affected by South Africa, there has been the terrible trauma for the families, for children, because Renamo was particularly brutal in its torture, in its mutilation, in absolutely unspeakable, unthinkable atrocities against the civilian population. And they estimate that between 300,000 to 500,000 children are psychologically damaged from having observed mutilation, having been forced, for example, to kill their own parents, having been kidnapped by Renamo and forced to kill others. So it is a tremendous, tremendous loss. Our State Department has called it one of the most brutal holocausts against ordinary people since World War II. And I was reading something written by a journalist in Harare. Even if Pretoria pulls back today from destabilization, it would leave a deadly legacy of region-wide destruction. Neither aid, nor resources, nor foreign investment will suffice to rebuild the farms and factories and transport lines ruined in the past decade. And no amount of money could undo the human damage wrought in a country like Mozambique. I was going to stop there, and we're certainly open for questions, but I discovered this, and I want to really recommend that everyone pick up a copy of this and get on the mailing list. It's I talked to a young, idealistic sounding, energetic sounding woman in Chicago the other day, and she had just come back from Mozambique, and she offered to send me these newsletters that they have. And one, what interested me most today, after reading and trying to organize all these horrific statistics on the damage of Renamo, in the center there's Renamo Watch, and it tells about the U.S. support and the effort in the United States to begin sending aid to Renamo, that not only would we be aiding UNITA in Angola, but now we are, President Bush and the administration has resisted this pressure. It's been there for several years. So far, we have resisted it. President Reagan also was very strong in resisting the pressure to assist Renamo. But this sheet lists various groups who are publicly supporting Renamo in this country. Gives their addresses, their phone numbers, and so forth. And something that is of interest, well, a couple things. The United States Global Strategy Council, which is a conservative think tank based in Washington, members include Jean Kirkpatrick and a couple others that I don't immediately recognize their name, have just written and given to members of Congress a book entitled Renamo, Anti-Communist Insurgents in Mozambique. But one thing that I found particularly distressful is in the box below where it lists U.S. supporters, so many of them are religious groups, religious right-wing groups. And I think we not only must we be urging, insisting, demanding that our government cease its assistance to UNITA in Angola, but we have to really be on our guard lest we start sending support to RENAMO. That would be the kind of the ultimate obscenity with our tax dollars. Are there questions or comments?
I was wondering, back when you said that Mozambique became independent and they set up their own judicial system and everything, were those people who were judges in the local areas, were they trained outside of the country or?
I'm sure at the local levels they were not, because there weren't that many with education that would qualify them to train outside of the country. I suspect they were local leaders. Yeah. Right after independence, there was a good bit of assistance from other countries for Mozambique. There were, for some reason, Mozambique has attracted more support for its independence than Angola has. And there were groups in Europe and in this country that provided a good bit of both financial assistance, and then people would go to Mozambique, you know, a six-month work team and so forth to try to build that.
But in healthcare too, I mean, I can see where the judges could be, but healthcare, it seems that they would need some expertise and some...
Well, they had to have had... they had to have embarked on a training program just massively there in those first few years. I don't know. Do you know about that, Jim?
No.
I know there were some international groups, again, that came in, you know, with nurses and primary health care givers. And that was still continuing in a few places. But when we were there in 1988, there were still some awfully courageous folks that were trying to hang on at the clinics in some of these isolated areas.
Who were the denominations in the world that did most mission work in Mozambique besides the Catholics?
Methodists, I think, were the strongest Protestants, far than all. There were Swedish Methodists. There were not many Protestant groups there. It was Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And that brings up something. The Lutheran Church, through LWF, Lutheran World Federation, did relief work there and also tried to help with water, you know, water development things. And the Lutheran Church, and then also the Tanzanians accepted a lot of refugees. So the Lutheran Church, which never had mission work there, has a very good reputation in Mozambique, and has been invited in and has been given a plot of land in the capital city of Maputo. And that's largely due to the Tanzanians and their wonderful reception and the good and the strong name, good name of the Lutheran Church in Tanzania, and then the Lutheran World Federation. But so we have not been involved there before and really you know, don't have a lot of knowledge. We've been picking it up during these past years, and now ELCA is a member of a new coordinating committee in Mozambique, so there will be some ties between ELCA and Mozambique. It's just beginning.
An American coordinating committee, or what?
No. It's an interesting thing there. With the invitation to come in there and work, the Tanzanians are sending a pastor in, and he's there, as far as I know, in Mozambique. And the Zimbabweans are sending in an evangelist, and...
That's all this work in Maputo.
Yeah, it's in Maputo. And then the funding is coming from Germany, Sweden, and the United States. And the Portuguese want to get involved. And that would be, I mean, the Brazilians, I'm sorry, with Portuguese. So, for instance, literature.
Oh, they would literature, have the language.
They would have the literature, at least for to start, until you could develop your own. Because Portuguese is the lingua franca, and there are very little Lutheran literature in Portuguese. But Brazil is going to be a member of that committee, too. To to try and do something there, on a small scale, starting in Maputo. Because the Roman Catholic Church, of course, had a terrible reputation there, as you know, because they were with the Portuguese government. So the Roman Catholics were held in very low esteem.
I noticed for the last several years, Zimbabwe has been sending not only financial aid and accepting refugees, but also soldiers that have been riding the train cars. You know, every train that goes across this Beira corridor, ahead of it and behind it and all along it are armed soldiers. And because of that, I noticed just in the accounts of last year, the amount of trade now going out through that Beira port there has gone up nearly 20%. So the possibilities are there if you could get rid of South Africa. But that's really a very sobering thing that this journalist writes, that it will, well, I'm sure it will be generations before the damage to the region. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about destabilization here, is you do not really hear much. You hear about South African apartheid and the effect it has within its own country, but the effects on the region as a whole may in some sense be even longer term than within the country itself.
Have any changes come about since de Klerk has taken over?
You know, I was talking with Janelle DeGrucci, and she said she has not heard the destabilization raised as an issue in any of the talks yet, and nor have I.
And nor have you, Jim.
No, I haven't. So far.
So if we don't know about the destabilization, and they solve the internal problems in South Africa, it's likely that we'll say, oh, good, they're doing it right now, so we'll support the South African government. Is that?
Well, if or when a black majority government in South Africa comes to power, their goals will not be to destabilize the region. It will be in everyone's interest to be developing the region.
And even in South, it's ironic because South Africa could economically benefit from the region being strong instead of the other way around, because they are the industrial manufacturing power of the subcontinent, and the trade, even now they're trading with all these countries under the table. There's all kinds of trade going on, because where else are they going to get the manufactured goods from? It would be to their benefit. So it's stupid of them to be doing this, but again, it's this paranoia and anti-communism and all kinds of stuff that's going on. It's nonsensical, besides being brutal. And then when you read this list in here of people like Senator Bob Casten from Wisconsin and Senator Bob Dole. You know Jesse Helms would be there.
Jimmy Swaggart,
Coors Brewery. I mean, it's really sad that they would waste money on and contribute to this.
Well, are they contributing to protect some interests they have there, I suppose?
Well, the Coors sell a lot of beer in Mozambique. I think they do. I don't think
all Coors. No, they don't.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the Coors company still has this totally ideological stance against anything that has ever been called communist.
The Swaggart ministries were very, very big all over Southern Africa. At least I shouldn't say all over, I've only been a couple places, but one of the nicest buildings in downtown Windhoek, Namibia was the Jimmy Swaggart headquarters there, and then also in Harare. It was a very nice, at least the size of this room, with tapes. You could come in and watch at any time and so forth. And we heard that all over in the back roads of Mozambique were trucks that said Jimmy Swaggart on them. So He's been very active there. Well, I think, lest we all
Don't
miss our dinner.
Do you have one word of encouragement to say?
It's so terrible. It makes you so angry.
It makes you so mad, yeah.
But we need to do, we need to write letters to our people in Congress, at least we can do it. Let them know somebody out there is...
Well, on this UNITA business, I think we have to just keep writing and writing, even if they don't respond. At least they're having to change the reasons why they don't respond.
Thank you.